podcast of 2020. I appreciate you so much for being there and listening during the year of 2019. And I just look forward to a great relationship and you being there for 2020. We're looking at doing a few different things in this year. I'm also going to really take time and concentrate on getting in book form the study that I'm doing in Romans. I'm working on a couple of chapters right now, the first couple of chapters right now, getting it. My process of writing a book is very slow because I am my worst critic and I can never get it said the way I want to. So just pray with me, if you will, about that. Also, speaking of that, my wife came through her surgery very well. She's doing well. She's progressing kind of slow as far as getting full range of motion in the knee. With her job, she's a nurse. She travels to different nursing facilities and does rounds with other nurses and that type of thing. So she has to have full range of motion and be able to do all the walking. So right now, they've advised her to just do the exercises and kind of gradually work her way back into the full schedule of traveling and doing those things. So thank you so much for your concern and for praying. And yeah, she's doing real well. Specifically, let me thank you, Herman. Herman reached out to me. He lives in Germany now, but actually I haven't heard from him in years. Jimmy Collins hears from him, I think, from time to time. But Herman, I'm so happy to hear from you, brother. I would love to stay in contact with you. He called, he left a message about, he was praying for my wife, but I didn't even realize that he was listening or knew about the podcast, and apparently he is in Germany, and I so appreciate you reaching out, man. It meant a lot. Thank you so much. But what I want to do in this introduction, this is, as you can tell by the title, this is a known of God lesson on that series that I've been posting up. And as I explained to you a couple of episodes before on the known of God lessons, I go through these lessons because the actual recording started in 2014. And as any of you know who are continually comprehending and coming to a clearer view of salvation and the immensity of it and the certainty of it as defined in the person of Christ, things change. Our perspectives change. The way we would say things changes, and not just because there's better ways to say it, but because there is a greater understanding that's just totally made the previous understanding obsolete, or it wasn't a true view. And as I went through this particular episode, you'll hear this, and I wanted to not edit this out because it would really hurt the flow and kind of leave you hanging. So when you hear this particular part, I want you to remember what I'm about to tell you. There's a part coming at the end of this lesson where I'll read from a commentary, and I like the way the commentary is worded, but there's something that I say based on the commentary that I did not like. And I've cut this out in many places because it would contribute the way it is said and the understanding with which I said it back in that time is flawed, because it lends itself to a misappropriation and a misunderstanding of things. During that portion of the lesson, I will read a quote from a commentary. I don't have all that in front of me, so forgive me. But something to the extent of this, that the work of the cross, the work of Christ, was to bring about a change, a necessitated change, to that which was an obstacle and that imposed itself as an obstacle to relationship. Because again, we're talking about being known of God. We're speaking about relationship. As you will remember, the last class we began to talk about the eternal context, the eternal relationship out from which he came, out from which the cross accomplished what God was after. And he came as the door of access to the sheep who would come unto him, a door into a relationship that was eternal, a relationship that is described in John 10, where we are right now in these lessons. But there was an obstacle to relationship, and the cross brought about a change to that thing that imposed itself as a real, true obstacle to fellowship with God. At that time, I said, so what is the obstacle? I asked that question. What is the obstacle to relationship? What is the obstacle to fellowship? And my simple answer was me and you. Now, I do not want to leave that hanging, okay? Because that simplified answer is dangerous. And we've talked about so many things that I see that way now, in a failure to elaborate, or even a failure to understand clearly these things. We would say things like that, and it's dangerous to leave those things hanging, because they can cause people to assume things, or even just that, say, I'm the obstacle. It's me, you. Then that has come in the past with questions to me and to others of saying, so what are you saying? God annihilates the soul of man. Does God annihilate man altogether and now it's just Christ? And there's so much confusion bound up in that, and so much confusion that will be bound up with that, just because we say we are the thing that stood in the way. And yet we're saying also we are the beneficiaries of the grace of God. What? That is a confusing thing. And it's confusing because it is flawed. And I've said it not in a malicious way to just point people in an erroneous direction, but I've said it because that was an understanding I had. But let me clarify without getting into it, because if you go into these Romans classes, you will see that I have explained these things, because you'll hear what I'm saying. You'll see I've explained these things throughout these lessons to where that statement should not throw you if you have the basis of listening to previous sessions, because of the work we did in Romans 5 and 7 and showing an internal condition that rendered man subject to a government of sin and death. And that was the obstacle. Here's the true thing that imposed itself as a true, unrelenting obstacle to fellowship with God and God's fellowship with us. If we make this broad statement, we are the problem, we're the hindrance that needs to be removed, that this can cause us to use the cross as, use it like it's an instrument of punishment, of execution that kills all mankind, executes all people, because sinful men are the obstacle to fellowship. But some of you may say, yeah, what's the problem with that? There's a big problem with just saying it that way. We have to understand, God was not after destroying the thing that he created. He's not out there to destroy the soul of man. And we're still breathing, even if we're born again, so he didn't kill the body. What is it that he removed? What is it that he brought to an abrupt and final end? What is it that stood as that great obstacle of separation? What made it impossible for fellowship to be a reality? There was necessitated the change. There wasn't a change that was necessary, and it had to do with the internal makeup, the internal condition of man. That was the state of man merely because he was born of the corruptible seed and therefore subjugated to the kingdom of that corruption, to the government of sin and death and corruptibility. There was an internal obstacle to fellowship. But not merely fleshly men, individual men. It was the government to which all men, all mankind, were subjugated. And again, internally subjugated. Paul calls it the law of sin and death. Paul calls such men, all men, slaves of sin, that we were subject to sin, subject to death. Because notice Paul's statement of desire and zealous efforts toward fellowship. Notice his statements. When I would do it. It's not that he didn't want to. He was just evil because he had no desire for God at all. No, he had every desire and he implemented zealously a divine law given of God to try to bring that desire to fruition. But there was something that was a true obstacle where he would cry out and say, when I would do good, evil is still present. The good that I would do, I do it not. This is not a man that's not trying to serve God. This is a man who's trying with all of his might to serve God. But yet his might falls short to bring about the change that is necessary because he is subject to an internal kingdom that rules and reigns from within. It is a true obstacle internally that held tightly and unrelentingly, keeping mankind bound to that obstruction. An obstruction, an obstacle that kept the soul at an unbridgeable distance from divine fellowship. The change that came about in Christ through the cross was actually regarding the soul, the nature of the soul's true captivity. Who is the ruler of the soul? Who truly has captured it? And to whom is the soul now a slave and subject, a servant? We've talked about that, right, throughout these classes. Is the soul subject to sin and death, or is it now a slave of righteousness as a subject of life, the life of Christ? You see it in somewhat of a picture in Exodus, right? God says, let my son, fellowship, go that he may serve me. See, their subject, Israel, his son, the declaration God gave, yet subject to Pharaoh, impeded this relationship to be enjoyed. There was something holding them under that subjection. Well, what is that? It has to do with being in sin, in death. That's what the whole picture was about. slaves to death and sin. And that subjecting power, that power that ruled over them, had to be eliminated. It was eliminated at the work of, by the work of the blood of the Lamb, where the firstborn of that subjecting, enslaving power was put away. And God's firstborn was set free. Paul will speak of it as being now released from subjugation to the first husband. This is in Romans 7. And being married to another. Being released from the headship of the first man to now being under the headship of a perfect man. And now, as those who are married to him, bearing fruit unto God through him. So it wasn't the soul of man and man as individuals who were so bad and so evil that just had to be killed by God. No, it was that subjecting government, that power that held us from within, that had to be put away, that had to be killed, that had to be eliminated, executed. That our soul that was subject to sin and death would now be made free and by being subject to life and righteousness. The obstacle was an internal thing. The true obstacle to fellowship was the absence of the one who brings that fellowship into us, crying, Abba, Father. And the seed from the first birth was the true thing that kept that from happening. Why? Because you must be born again. Another seed has to come. Another man. The soul must be united to another, having been released from the hold and the grip of the first. I hope this has clarified it. So when you hear that, I want you to hear it with that caveat, with that explanation. And I could have gone on and on. But as I said, these Romans classes has said a lot of that. And if you haven't listened to the Romans classes except this one, I encourage you to go back and listen to them because they will help you understand more clearly what I have just said. But I thought, I can't just let that go. I can't just leave you hanging. I couldn't cut it out because it would leave you hanging because there'd been no answer to the question. But when I heard the answer that I gave back in 2014, I thought, no, I can't do that. I can't just leave that there. Again, these are the beautiful things and the not so beautiful things about coming to a greater clarity. You have to say I was wrong. Not only did I say that wrong, the perspective out from which those words came was wrong. So I hope this has helped clarify that. And when you hear it, you can hear it with this already in the back of your mind. So again, guys, thanks so much for being with us and thanks for listening. Hopefully you'll stay during the whole of 2020 with me and we'll continue together to grow in this grace and the knowledge of the Lord Jesus. Amen. All right, we're still looking at the theme of being known of God. Last week, let me just read again the verse out from which all this came, this study.
This is Galatians 4:9. But now, after that ye have known God, or rather are known of God, how turn ye again to the weak and beggarly elements whereunto you desire again to be in bondage? So we're talking about this known of God, this being known of God. We haven't been talking as much yet about our knowing of God, which is how that reality becomes effectual and becomes the governing understanding of our heart. But we are attempting in these first classes, or in these classes that we've had so far and tonight, to attempt to scripturally establish as much as possible, as much as I'm able to do it, to establish the ground, the basis, the certain and sure basis out from which all of our pursuit of knowing God should proceed, from which it would begin. Because most of us, I know most of my Christian life was me attempting to pursue God upon the ground of my religious assumptions and my speculations of what it was and what it meant to have a relationship with God. And men would say, this is what it means and this is how it looks. So I would try to emulate and imitate those things so that I would too, in my imagination, in my understanding, have an acceptable or good relationship with God. But the Lord has began to deal with me, and really he's been in my heart about relationship with him ever since I saw Christ. That has been just a theme that continually comes, or I'm continually brought back to that theme of what is relationship with me? What is relationship with God? What is it? How does God relate to me, and how do I therefore relate to him? And we've said it in these classes that it has to do with covenant. It has to do with God's covenant. It has to do with God's understanding. And I had attempted all of my Christian life to attempt to relate to God based upon my theory of how God related to me, because I believed God related to me by looking at me and assessing my actions and my activities and my thoughts and my motivations. And so he would judge those things, and then in that judgment he would base his relationship to me upon that judgment, upon how I was doing, how well I was doing, what I was doing wrong or right. But I began to see God's relationship with me never changes. It's not up and down. It's not in and out. It's not hot and cold one day, you know. What's hot and cold may be, up and down may be, my comprehension, my soul's understanding of the perfect relationship God has given as the gift to my soul. That's the only variable in this scenario. That's always the only variable. That was the variable during God's dealing with Israel. That was the variable with God's dealing with every man throughout the testimony. It was never God's relation to them that had any doubt or variations to it. It was their understanding of his relationship and thereby their misunderstanding of how to relate to him. And they would, you know, we know all the things that happened. So that is the catalyst for these studies, is that the Lord is dealing with my heart about the certainty of the thing. How certain, how absolute and real and perfect. And I use all of these words that to try to say it, and they even fall short. Our relationship with God has no missing element to it. God has known us perfectly in a perfect relationship. And that is what we're trying to at least establish in a scriptural way throughout the testimony and the writers of the New Testament, how they declared pictures of this perfect relationship with God. And we're also going to look in upcoming classes at men misunderstanding that relationship and attempting to relate to God upon some other ground or basis, and the consequence of that, and how God will never stop proving the point. There was one and only one who will stand before me. There is only one I love. There is only one with whom my relationship is established. And you are either found in that one and are having that one revealed in you as your relationship with me, or you have no idea of the relationship I have with you. And that can cause some terrible things, and it does. Ignorance of that can cause turmoil and pain. Paul calls it an evil and perverse generation. Or Jesus calls it that. Paul calls it an evil age, that age of the old covenant understanding. And God actually had given them his understanding of relationship in the law and in the ceremonies and in all of those things. God had given to them, and we've talked about it, a covering. They were kept and covered by God's understanding of Israel under the offerings and the sacrifices and the feasts and the Sabbaths. God's understanding kept them and clothed them. And guess what? It does us. It does us. The thing that I began to understand was God did not put, and I think this has a lot to do with this little phrase here, you turn again to the weak and beggarly elements whereunto you desire again to be in bondage. The reason Israel, especially Israel, was put into captivity and in the bondage of Babylon was because, not because they neglected their rest, they neglected their Sabbath, it was because they violated God's. You understand? In the Sabbaths, God, in the feasts and the festivals, God had given them his rest, his Sabbath. That's why it talks about in Hebrews about how they wouldn't walk by faith, and they wouldn't, and all of the things that it says there, and it talks about although the works were finished before the foundation of the, or from the foundation of the world. And he's talking, he's going back to the creation and saying it was all done, God saw it, it was good, and it says God rested from his labor. And that is the rest that he offered to his people, and they would not walk in that rest. They violated that rest, so they were put in bondage. It's the same thing with us. We live in the bondage of laws and religion because we are always, until we see the place of his rest, until our soul is beholding the Sabbath of God in the face of his Son, the place where his rest is found. This is my Son in whom I am fully and perfectly, eternally delighted. He could say, this is the place of my rest. Here's my Sabbath. This is where the dove rested. This is my Son. And we live continually in violation, in ignorance, and therefore in violation of God's Sabbath. And we end up in the bondage of self, effort, and imagination. That's the result. So it's more than just neglecting God, the rest God gave us. It is us violating the rest God himself has. It is my soul attempting to have God relate to me in a way that is violating his only relationship to me. And that doesn't change God's view. Because everything for us, every step, every forward movement in the progress of the believer, in the in the pursuit of the believer begins upon the ground of rest. It begins on the basis of rest. If it doesn't, you're not pursuing him on the proper basis. If you're trying to get to a place of rest, then your pursuit is going to be one of turmoil and torture and heavy laden and all of that that Jesus speaks about. That is why our true pursuit, I believe, now this is what I think the scriptures teaches, that our true pursuit, the moment where we begin to truly apprehend that for which we are apprehended, that we begin to know even as or according to the way we are known of God, is when that Son is revealed in our soul, because it's then that we see the true ground upon which we stand. We see the rest of God. We see the place of God's satisfaction. And from that moment, from that point, we will allow the Spirit of God to take us on into that perfection. And we can grow and live in the light of that perfection. But until then, there's no basis. And religion, the Christian religion, has no basis to pursue God. That is why most people's idea of what it means to serve God or go after or pursue the Lord is, there's 20 million different ideas of what that means. Paul's idea was very singular, and this is the idea. This is the basis. What is it? To know Him and the power of His resurrection. In the fellowship of His sufferings. What is that fellowship of His sufferings? See, the fellowship of His suffering is only realized when we know Him as the resurrection. We know Him as life, the one who lives, the one who remains. Then we can know fellowship in His sufferings. And that is my soul suffering the loss of everything that the cross has put away. That everything that Christ and Him crucified has eliminated. Therefore, my soul is no longer attached to something that God has put away from Himself. That God has taken out of the picture and no longer relates to. Being made conformable to His death. Yes, that's what does it. My soul being circumcised from everything that the cross has circumcised it from. That's sanctification. The soul experiencing what the cross has already brought to a reality or made a reality. The soul experiencing the judgment and the blessing. The judgment and the blessing that is already in you. That's why I'm saying it all begins from a basis, a standpoint of rest. Of what is in Christ, what is perfect in Christ. Brother Arliss and I were talking about this earlier in Hebrews 6. Let us be the actual rendering of it is called in the passive is let us be being carried on to that which is perfect. It's not let us get to something perfect. You've got to remember the Hebrew letter is wrote to those who have come in reality from the first to the second, from the natural to the spiritual, from the testimony to the substance of the testimony. And he's saying what we need to do is not to lay those things again where or relate, you could say, relate to those elemental things again as we did under the types and the figures. We need to allow the Spirit of God to bring us on unto that perfect substance to which they pointed. Now, how does that happen? He says it in the previous chapter. The senses being exercised, that we may discern what is good and what is evil. And basically, he's saying the same thing. Well, I won't go there, but basically, because this is not what I want to talk about. But he's saying the same thing there. The good and evil is not what we think good and evil is. The word good there means surpassing in its nature. Surpassing in excellence. The word evil there means of no, missing something, lacking in excellence, lacking something of substance. So he's saying the senses, that means the soul, those, you know, as we have the natural senses that's been given to us to know the natural world and the natural realm, God has given corresponding senses that we may know the things of the Spirit. That is the eyes of the soul. He that hear, let him hear what the Spirit is saying. That's not with these ears. That's with the ears of the heart. That's the ears that must be open to his voice, that hears the voice of the Son of Man so we could live. So those are corresponding senses has to be exercised continually. And that word there, you could take it, I've said it many times, it means to be uncovered. It means to exercise uncovered. And that means to have the covering that's over the senses of the soul removed. The veil taken away and continually not beholding the things that are evil, but the things that are surpassing in excellence. That's how we are carried on from the first to the second, in experience, because we already have been carried on in reality. If you read commentaries and word studies, you realize that most commentaries will say it's called the letter of Hebrews. The word comes from the Hebrew word eber, which means crossing over from one land to another. So he's talking to those who have crossed over, and those who need to, in experience, cross over. Or make a transition, if you say it that way. The transition is an understanding. The translation has already taken place. We've already been brought from darkness unto the kingdom of his Son, or darkness to light, from the kingdom of darkness to the kingdom of the Son of his love. It's my soul that must experience that reality. That's the necessity. And so in these first classes, we're driving home as much as possible the fact of our being brought from the one to the other and how certain that is. Because if that's not certain, then the pursuing of the knowing of it is not certain. So, at least as much as I can do as someone who stands here is just tell you what the Scriptures say, and hopefully the Spirit of God, or we will allow the Spirit of God to bring us on unto the meaning and the reality of these words. So, to not belabor that any longer, let's go on in the class. The word know, even as we are known of God, the word know, we've said it before, is not like an intellectual assessment by God that God has by which he relates to man, as I've said before. The word is actually a word that means, in the Greek, it means a participatory relationship, or a relationship in which there is a participation between the one that is knowing and the person that is being known. There's a fellowship, there's a relationship there. Adam knew his wife. It's that word in the Greek that also, it says that. It's the same word in the Septuagint, but it's about knowing, intimacy. It's a knowing, it's a relationship. It has nothing to do with this. It has everything to do with the mind, the knowing of God being worked in my soul. That is how we finally come to know even as we are known. It's not that my intellect gets keen enough or my theological understanding gets so good that I finally figure it out. It is God's eternal knowing of me. We're going to look at this later. This is his knowing. And this knowing finally being revealed in my heart to where I know even as I am known. Because this is how I am known of God. This third thing about laying down my life for the sheep, if for those of you who just listened to the audio, I have 1, 2, 3. I have the same phrases from John 10:15 up here. As the Father knows me, even so know I the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep. And I have each one of those phrases numbered 1, 2, 3. The first two is the eternal knowing of God, that fellowship. And then this, the third one, I lay down my life for the sheep, is that door by which we are brought into this knowing. So what is our knowing even as we are known? Again, it's not figuring out my place here. It's figuring out My union, it's not figuring out. It's comprehending my union with this one who is knowing his Father. Knowing as I am known is having this knowledge, this relationship, you can say, this fellowship revealed in my soul. Then can I know as I am known and try and cease attempting to get God to know me in any other way. All right. Now that I thoroughly confused you. It's an intimate fellowship in which the soul is permitted to participate. But such a participation in the soul or by the soul comes only in the understanding of the nature and context of this fellowship. So, I've stressed this, that even as we are known, even so know I the Father. Those are very important phrases because it lets us know that it doesn't exist here and it's not permitted here when I am permitted to be to participate in this relationship. It's not permitted for me to bring in my own conjectures or personal interpretations of what it means to relate to God. There is a knowledge that governs this relationship. There is a knowing that governs this fellowship that's eternal and perfect. And that knowing must come into my heart, must be revealed in working in my soul, or else I will never benefit from this fellowship. There can be, and there is, if I am born again, because of the words that we have, the verses in chapter 4 of Galatians that we read earlier classes, that the seal of your sonship is the fact that we have the Spirit of His Son, and it's called the Spirit of adoption. The Spirit of His Son that comes into our hearts crying out, Abba Father. That seals it. I love it. That's the seal of your sonship. Not, have you prayed enough? Have you done enough? Have you lived right? No, he is the right life. You can't live right. You either have the right life or you don't. You know, most of us don't know the life we have, so we're trying to live the best life we can. And I'm not saying that knowing Christ as my life gives me the license to live any natural life I want or any way I want in the natural. That's not what I'm saying. The one will govern the other. What I'm saying is the whole thing is premised upon and based upon and has its source in the life that God has given. I've always said the life that God receives and accepts is the life that He has given. And that's it. Otherwise, we're going to try to live our life for God. Now, even as, there's no room here, and this shows it, no room for conjecture, personal interpretation, my speculations. When it comes to the soul experiencing salvation as it truly is in Christ, there's no room for any of that. And most people live there. I lived in speculation and assumptions all my life before I saw the Lord. The only moment of certainty in my heart came, and I mean certainty as to my relationship with God, after serving the Lord as hard as I could and as diligently as I could and as I was told, the only moment of security and sureness in all of those years came when I saw this Son, when I saw the Son of His love. The Son of His love. And that took all of the weight off of me and put all the weight on Him. And I don't mean saying, oh, I'm free of any responsibility. What I'm saying is, He becomes the source of it all, the basis of it all, not me. As I said, I think last classes, Brother James Register in Florida, he said this one time during a conference, would to God that we comprehended how of God and not of us our salvation truly is. And I'm beginning to see how not of us it is. That doesn't release me from moral responsibilities. But that does release me from the bondage of self-centered pursuit of God. It relieves me and frees my heart from beholding my face and trying to make it look like His. It liberates my soul that the God who has graced my soul with the person of His Son could reveal in me and unveil my soul to the beauty of salvation. And He'll do that only by revealing the beautiful Son of His love. Now, the word speculation seems, there's that word in Hebrews again about seem, you would seem to have come short of it, and there's the fear of seeming to have come short of it. Something's going to seem to be missing. And that word's actually there, and it means exactly what it says. Seem. Therefore, labor to come into the rest. Not labor to get there, labor to know the rest that you've been brought to. Remember, crossed over. You've already been brought there. The fear that Paul, or the writer of Hebrews, presents is not a fear, as most translators and commentaries would have us think. Not the fear that we have come short, but the fear that we would seem in our hearts to have come short. You know why? Because that assumption of shortness or have missing something or lacking something lends itself to this, turning again to weak and beggarly elements and being brought under their bondage. This relationship being revealed in my soul, this knowing of the Father and the knowing of the Son, and that knowing that is perfect and eternal, nothing lacking there. When that is being revealed in my heart, there's no assumption or seeming to come short of anything. There's only the desire to know the fullness to which we've come. And I'll know in my heart that that is not a work that I can do, but that is the work to which I must submit. Or a work that the Spirit of God only can do, to which my soul must submit. All right, so my pursuit and the expectation toward God will be and should be and only can be, if it's actually to be a proper pursuing, upon the certainty of His knowing, His fixed eternal relationship. And again, this takes us back to Amos 3 and 3, where we started these classes. How can two walk together except they be agreed? And we've taken that to mean, how do we as Christian brethren walk together? Well, that has its place. But he's talking about Him. He's talking about God. How do you walk with God except you be agreed? And most of us are not in agreement with God. And that word agreed there is actually a derivative of the word moed in the Hebrew, which means a fixed and appointed place, a fixed and appointed time. Meaning, how can we walk as one together in union except we be in the fixed and live in the fixed place in the fixed time? Understanding. It's about an understanding. I'm attempting to know God in a way He doesn't know me, and He knows me in a way that I don't understand. So although I say, oh, I'm born again, I'm Christian, and you are, the agreement is not there. My soul is not in agreement with reality. My soul is not comprehending the perfection to which it has been brought, therefore I'm living in contradiction to it. Because I'm still attempting to know a salvation, and I'm still trying to find my place in it. I'm still trying to have a relationship with God that has me in it, or as the center of it. But I want to take this back to something we said in the last class about the door. We talked about relationship in the door. And I'm going to try to speed through some of this, but in the context of these phrases that I have written on the board being spoken, In that same context, Jesus says, I am the door of the sheep. I am the door. If by me any man shall enter in, he shall go in, go out, and he'll find pasture. I am the door. This relationship and God and Christ declaring himself to be the door in the context of him describing an eternal relationship in which he is involved, a knowing that he is involved in. It is significant that he then, or before that, declares who he is, the door of the sheep, that they may come by him, enter into him, into what? This relationship. This fellowship that is perfect, unbreakable, fixed forever, can't be added to or taken away from. And he presents himself as the door into such a fellowship. And one of the beautiful things that this conveys to the person reading these words, as the Father knows me, even so know I the Father, just those two phrases conveys this. There is something perfect, something eternally perfect that exists between the Father and the Son before he laid down his life. I want us to understand that. We have to understand that. That is the basis out from which he lays down his life for the sheep. Otherwise, it would be just like we're taught in religion. That he came to make something perfect, and he forgives us so that we can also try to be perfect. So we believe that our being born again adds to something, make something more perfect than it always has. That's why they're always saying, we got to get more people born again. I mean, you know, Jesus is waiting on us. He's not going to come back until we do this. You understand? That is a false thing. That's not, there was something perfect before he came. There was a relationship that was absolute and perfect before he came. It was out from that relationship he came. Or I could say, in the reality of that relationship, he came to lay his life down as the door of the sheep. So that we may be brought to something that's already finished, perfect, eternal. Which means, and this hurts a lot of people's feelings, this means that me being born again doesn't add to this at all. And that should give me the most reason to rejoice. Because God has brought me into something that doesn't need me to be perfect. He's offered to my soul, or given to my soul, for those who are born again, he's given my soul, your soul, a perfect relationship with him by reason of the door, laying down the blood, the cross. That has brought us into something perfect, eternal, real. I halfway thought all of this God stuff was an illusion. I mean, before I saw Christ, I'd got to the point where I was questioning everything. Is this really true, or is this a bunch of make-believe? Because it seems so abstract. It seems so substanceless. It's unsubstantiated to the natural mind. But when this eternal reality is revealed in your heart, there's no question, is it real? Because what you've done is that beginning, before seeing him, you've attempted to base what you believe is real, or to base the reality of your salvation upon you, other people, or surrounding situations. So you say, is this real? He's not living it. I'm not living it. Are these people living it? Most people say, I don't even go to church, all those hypocrites. You know? Why? You're basing your whole idea of what it means to be born again, what it means to have relationship with God, upon the wrong thing. So yeah, it doesn't seem real, and it seems like there's just a bunch of make-believe in it all. Until your soul is unveiled to that which is above. This is that which is above. This relationship is what is above. That's what Paul says, set your affection there. Because all of the things you're attempting to do, holy days and all of the things, circumcision, in the context of Paul's letter, all of those things are just, they were a shadow. They have no substance. The substance is Christ. The body that casts those shadows is Christ. But until you see what is above, you're still going to grovel in the mud of what is below, trying to make it work. And trying to make it perfect and make it good enough and try to make it measure up. Well, here's where the measure of the fullness is. Not in this, not in below, not below on the earth, not in you or me. It's found in Him. Amen. Nowhere else. And God does not look for it anywhere else because His eye is eternally fixed on the face of His beloved Son. And you're either found in that Son or not. If you're found in that Son, what has to happen for my soul to experience the joy of that? The Father has to reveal the Son who is your life. Reveal in your soul the one who is your relationship with Him. And then, from that point on, you don't have a below is not your premise for pursuing Him. Above is the premise from which you pursue the knowing of Him. Our citizenship is in heaven from whence we look. We look from a standpoint of being risen with Him. We look from a standpoint of something eternally perfect being our state of being. We can go to the testimony and how Israel related to God under the law. And you see the same thing there. And we may do that in later classes. But we were examining the nature of the door. And understanding that will help us understand our relationship, or the nature of our relationship with God and the nature of God's knowing toward us. There is only, and we said it in the last class, and I hate to keep going back to that, but 2 weeks go by, you know, I forget. We did say that relationship, there is only one relationship in the door. The door is not open wide so that every Adamic man could come in and possess his own personal relationship with God. Now, the relationship we have with God must personally be experienced and known. Yes, but there is only one relationship that we all possess. Christ, all and in all. So in that relationship, there is neither Jew, Gentile, male, female. Why is that? Because of the nature of the door. And because of the perfection of this relationship, that door gives us access into. There can't be a male or a female or a Jew or a Greek. There can't be bond or free. Any of those distinctions, those things cannot be found in this fellowship. But whether we're Jew, Gentile, male, or female, that one fellowship is our relationship with God. You understand that? The cross, the door, has eliminated the distinctions of flesh, and they're not found here. Why? Because God is never related to that, except the only way He's related to a Jew is when that nation was a testimony of the one with whom His relationship is established. When they rejected that one, they rejected God's relationship with them. But God's relationship was never never was touched by it. God's view was never deviated from this one, regardless. When we come into the door, we come into a perfect reality that existed before we did. A reality that is of God and not of us. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 14. For the love of Christ constraineth us, and thereby we thus judge, that if one died for all, then are all dead. Now, last time we wrote on the board here, we had the cross, and then we had all of these different people, you know, out. Oops, I gave him a crooked arm. Anyway, I could draw more, take too much time. We have here, you know, Billy, Bobby, and Susie, and all those people. And we think, this is how we think relationship with God goes. God forgives us so that we can have, finally, a relationship with God. And so, Bobby, Billy, and Susie have their own thing going with God. And so, one of them has a better one than this one because I pray more, or I fast, and you don't, and I go to this denomination, and you don't, and all of those distinctions are there. Why? Because if we're not seeing this reality, guess what we're seeing? We're seeing us and we're comparing ourselves one to another. And we'll compare how good your relationship with God is compared to mine. See how ignorant we are when we're looking below to try to find a reality that is above? So this is our understanding. Well, that's not the understanding. When Christ died, all died, right? Don't mean they physically died. It means they died unto God. God's relationship to all men was terminated by the cross. And by the cross, man was finally judged to be dead unto God and dead in sin. The final judgment of that. Now, so what happens? All men died. Here's what happens. Here's the rest of it. Let me read verse 14 again. For the love of Christ constrains us, we just judge that one died for all, then all were dead. And that he died for all, that they which live should not henceforth, from this moment on, live unto themselves, but unto him which died for them and rose again. So what happens here? He dies, all men are dead. Right? They're dead in sin. Dead in sin. So what he does by the cross, by the death, burial, and resurrection, he becomes the door. And he says, and the scripture will say it like this, the dead that shall hear his voice shall live. Shall hear the voice of the Son of Man, I think it said it that way, shall live. So those who will come to the one who calls them, here's this one. This is what exists beyond the cross. Not many, but one. Not all of us born again people. One Son in resurrection. One life. One righteousness. One holiness. This is how simple the new covenant is. This is how simple and exclusive the new creation is. One lives. So what does that one do? And that one is, of course, Christ, the Son of God's love, the Son that was raised up by the glory of His Father. He calls to those who are dead. And those that will hear his voice and come by way of the door will live. But this says, so that they will not live again unto themselves, but unto him. Well, how does that happen? That means they would no longer have this as their life. They would not live to themselves. They would not have a life of their own, but they would live by the one who died for them and rose again. Why does he think it's significant to say not only died, but rose? Because he becomes the resurrection and the life of all who will live here. So that they would now live unto God. And there's two distinct, I mean, we could do it this way, and I know you can draw it in a million different ways, but now, Billy and Bobby, well, I'm not even going to draw that, have Christ in them. The one who lives now, that has called them out of death into life, is now made unto them life, is their life, is their relationship with God. He has brought this fellowship into their hearts. And now it's not many relating to God, it's many in whom one relationship lives. It's many in whom God, in whom the Son lives, and that Son is in eternal relationship to His Father. And what I'm telling you is this, that Abba Father is taking place in your soul, whether your soul is cognizant of it or not, whether your soul acknowledges it or not and participates in that fellowship. You wouldn't be born again if that fellowship wasn't taking place in you, because that's what being born again is all about. My Father and I will come and we will make our abode in you. What is that? It's fellowship. It's an eternal relationship being brought into the soul of man, and Christ living in every man as their relationship with God. Their one and only relationship. That they might not any longer live unto themselves, but unto Him. Now, what is that? There are two verses that come to mind. Galatians chapter 2. Verse 19, for I through the law am dead to the law, that I might live unto God. See, Paul under the law was trying to live unto God. He was trying to live for God. He was trying to live unto God, or live acceptable. Something unto God means it's something that God looks at and receives and accepts. And he says, so by the law, here's the reality now for him, is by the law, I had to become dead to the law so that I could truly live unto God. In other words, the law, as it was supposed to, brought him to Christ, which means brought him to his end, brought him to his death, so that Christ may live in his soul, or what we have here, as the end of the law for righteousness' sake. As the righteousness the law spoke of. As the fulfilled righteousness of God. So he says, that I might live unto God. Now how does he define living unto God? He doesn't define it by prayer, fasting, or any of those things. And none of those things are bad. They're just bad when they become the means by which we relate to God. Or try to get a relationship with God to improve based on our doing of those things. That's what makes it wrong. So how does he define what it means to live unto God? Here it is, verse 20. I am crucified with Christ. Wait a minute. That's not living unto God. This is living unto God. I am crucified with Christ. Nevertheless, I live. Yet, not I, but Christ liveth in me. And the life which I now live in this flesh, I live by the faith of the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. Now, that's what it means to live unto God. Not I, but Christ liveth in me. Why? Why is that? Because God doesn't accept another life. God doesn't relate to anyone but his Son who lives in you. How are you going to live unto God except by the one who truly lives unto God? In Romans says that, and Romans brings it out in another way, but it says the same thing here. Chapter 6 of Romans, You can read the whole thing, but I'm just going to cut in here. For in that he died unto sin once, but in that he liveth unto God. He liveth unto God. In that he liveth unto God. Likewise, reckon ye also yourselves to be dead indeed unto sin, but alive unto God through Jesus Christ our Lord. That's not you living unto God on your own. That's you possessing in your soul the only life that truly lives unto God. Now, in the other class, we also talked about that he was set forth as a propitiation. This is in Romans chapter 3. Which, you know, this all ties together. All of the things in Romans tie together. Chapter 3 leads us up to chapter 4, 5, 6, and 7, and 8. I mean, it's a letter. So in Romans 3, he begins to talk about there being no distinctions between man, whether Jew or Gentile, before God. That in the sight of God, and he says the law itself declares this, that none are righteous, none are holy. Man is man, whether it's a Jewish flesh or Gentile flesh. It doesn't matter. We're all the same because all have sinned and fallen short. That's not meaning you just do sins. That means you are sin continually. That's your nature, and it can't be changed. All have sinned, come short of the glory of God. And by the way, this is the glory of God. Clothe me with the glory I had with thee from the beginning. It's this fellowship, this relationship. Now, many sons unto glory. Well, they come short of glory. Man comes short of this. So he talks about Christ being the propitiation of sin and all of this. And of course, he'll get into the asking the question, where then is your boasting? And he says it is excluded, which means to be shut out of a door that will prohibit access or entrance. I mean, it takes you right to Noah, and everybody gets in the boat, but it really only Noah gets in, and those who are with him in the ark, is how it's said in Genesis. Because Noah's the only one God saw and found grace in the eyes of God, the only one who he beheld as righteous. And it says the door, God shut them in. And everything else was washed away. Everything else was purged away by God. Everything else was cleansed away. And only Noah remained. Everything else was shut out of a door and was washed away. That's something, when that realization is something of knowing even as we are known of God. It's something of what Peter talks as a good conscience by the resurrection. We'll talk about that in later classes, but it has to do with understanding the door, understanding the judgment, and understanding the one who remains beyond the flood. The one who identifies a totally new creation. But the word propitiation here means, in the Greek, it's the same word used in the Septuagint for mercy seat in the tabernacle. And Kenneth Weiss says this: this word is used in the Septuagint in the sense of an atonement or a reconciliation. It refers to the act of getting rid of sin, which has come between God and man. Listen to these words. The scriptural conception of this word is not that of just appeasing one who is angry. See, I thought that was what it was. And I thought my good works would do the same thing. Appease an angry God. Most people have turned away from religion because they think that there is an angry God up there. Or either they say, well, he was angry during the Old Testament, now he's not so angry. Because Jesus appeased an angry God. That's not it. That's a pagan concept of appeasing God with sacrifices. making them not so mad. Because, you know, if they're mad, then earthquakes will happen. And God, that stuff's being preached now. Today. Because we ain't going any further than a pagan concept of relationship with God. So Christ appeased him. I have to appease him. But it's not that of appeasing a God who is angry, but of altering the character of that which occasions a necessary alienation and interposes an inevitable obstacle to fellowship. Did you catch all those? Listen to these. I love this. It is the altering, and I'm going to show you, it altered it all right. I am crucified. That's an altering. All men died. That's altering. It's not just changing it a little bit. It's altering it forever. Changing the nature of it altogether. What is it? Dead. Altering the character of that which occasions a necessary alienation, or that which makes it necessary or causes an alienation from God. That which interposes or brings in an obstacle to fellowship. What is the obstacle to fellowship with God? Me. You. I can't. There is an alienation there. And I believe that's just a beautiful understanding of propitiation. Colossians says it this way. Colossians chapter 1. Verse 19. And on. For it pleased the Father that in him should all fullness dwell, having made peace through the blood of his cross, by him to reconcile all things unto himself. By him, I say, whether they be in earth or things in heaven. And you that were sometime alienated and enemies in your mind, by is not there. It's in wicked works. Not you just did them. You were in them because you were in the person out from whom those works came. You were in the wicked, the darkness. But you were alienated and enemies in your mind by wicked or in wicked works, yet now hath he reconciled in the body of his flesh through death to present you holy, unblameable, and unreprovable in his sight. How in the world does that happen? It happens, remember we defined in a previous class, the one who stands in the sight of God, unreprovable, unblameable. That's how it happens. We were alienated because we are the obstacle to fellowship. We necessitate alienation because of our nature and who we are. So by his cross, he put away everything that alienates, every object that would necessitate alienation from God, everything that's an obstacle to this relationship, he put it away by his cross. So that he could present us unreprovable, unblameable, holy, unblameable, and unreprovable in God's sight. How does that happen? That we now, by his cross, by being born again, live in him. Having nothing of our own, he is made unto us all things that he is, and the one that stands in the sight of God as holy, unblameable, unreprovable, and perfect is my life. And he stands in the sight or in the presence of God for us. Not I, but Christ liveth in me. That's the only way that you're ever unblameable, unreprovable. That's it. You don't live. He lives in you. You don't have a relationship with God of your own. He is your relationship with God. You understand? God, by His cross, Christ by the cross, has eliminated everything that's an obstacle to this eternal relationship. And He calls our soul to enjoy this eternal, above relationship, and brings it into the soul of everyone who will answer and hear His voice and come by the door. The moment you come in the door is the moment you come into the reality. It is not I, but Christ who liveth in me. That's the moment you come in. The realization of that is an eternal realization. And that realization comes every time I see the one who lives in the sight of God, who is the sight of God, and is unblameable and perfect in His sight. Brings my mind back to a Vine's Dictionary definition that he had on forgiveness, which was the removal of the cause of offense. That's forgiveness. That's what he did. He forgave us our sin. Why? He removed the cause of sin. He removed us. Now the only one who lives unto God is the one who lives in me. What a beautiful thing. How certain is that? How sure is that? Again, that is sure. That's a reality. If He lives in you, that is the reality. That is your certain state of being. The question, however, is, are you knowing Him? Is that one who is perfect in the sight of God, with whom God's relationship is eternally established, is He the one being revealed in your soul, and in the light of His face, are you knowing relationship with God? That's the question. That is the only question. Are we allowing the Spirit to bring us on in the view of that perfect one? That is why Paul will ask this question in Romans 3. Wherefore is your boasting? Where is boasting? Where is a ground? And I looked up this word, boasting. And it's the word kaukesis in the Greek. 27:46, the act of boasting. But it is a derivative or akin to kalkima, which is, it's from that word, kalkima, I think this 27:44, which speaks of the ground or basis of boasting. He could say this, having seen Christ as the propitiation, the mercy seat. And it goes on, I have it all here and I'm not going to get to it, but to be the place of God's satisfaction is what propitiation means, and I wanted to get there. But anyway, seeing that Christ stands before God and stands in your, or well, if you're born again, stands in your heart as the righteousness of God and the right, or let's say it this way, the way he says it in Romans 3, that God has shown him, who is the propitiation, to be the righteous one and the righteousness of those who believe, he will say, seeing that that's true, brethren, where's your ground of boasting? What ground are you standing on and boasting upon? Do you have one? It's like God says to Israel, I'm going to do this in this way so that you will not say in your heart that my righteousness has gotten me to this place. My righteousness brought me to this land. The cross makes that an impossibility if we understand the cross. The door does not permit such boasting. Our boasting is only in the one, as Paul will say it, and we'll get to that in the next class, the one who stands before the face of God and is therein made unto me everything he is in the sight of God. That our boasting would stand, that the ground of our boasting would not be in the faults and imagination of our heart, looking at ourselves, assessing ourselves, but that we would boast in the Lord, who is our relationship with God. That we would glory in the not I, but Christ reality. Not just quote it as a verse, but rejoice in the reality of it. Knowing that God has put away the object of alienation. May this be the knowing, the knowledge that is at work in our hearts, so that our souls would be relating to God according to an eternal and fixed and perfect reality, and not in our assumptions, speculations.